Welcome to the 387th edition of Travel Itch Radio, brought to you tonight by the best holiday gift of the year, my book, The New Baseball Bible, Notes, Nuggets, Lessons, and Legends from Our National Pastime. 480 pages for just a sawbuck, such a deal. Make sure you get the 2020 version with Mike Trout on the cover. Mary Ellen?
Our special guest tonight is Richard Peterson, president of the U.S. Cultural and Heritage Marketing Council and the publisher of The Cultural Traveler. Welcome, Richard, to Travel Itch Radio.
Well, thank you very much, Dan and Mary Ellen, for the opportunity to join you both this evening on the show.
Well, let's jump right in. Where, when, and why did the women's suffrage movement start?
You know, it's a really interesting conversation we're going to have this evening, Dan and Mary Ellen, and it's an honor, as I said, to be with you both as your listeners are tuning in. And it's one of the most consequential moments in our nation's history as we talk about the women's suffrage movement. And regarding your question as to where, when, and why the women's movement started, we really need to go back in history to the early and mid-1800s in the country when a key motivator for the movement was the strong belief and conviction that women needed to be treated equally beyond what the current status quo was of that time and what was dictated to them by men and what their visions were for the future. So those national, international perspectives that were blending around the anti-slavery efforts also acted really as catalysts for the women to take stronger stances on the issues of equality and the vote. And if I can say one more thing as to the why, the preamble to the Declaration of Independence, you know, really brings it all to light. And we all kind of look to our nation's documents, our founding documents, you know, as a guide. And, you know, the preamble, which says, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, really was a catalyst as well. And with that in mind, in the summer of 1848, you know, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott, among many other notable women, convened in Seneca Falls, New York, to hold the first gathering of the women's rights discussion.
So would you say it was just one person who started it or a committee?
You know, as mentioned briefly just a moment ago, it definitely was this collective effort of several committed and focused and very, you know, what people would say, you know, of the time, strong-willed women that realized that the strength of the women's suffrage movement could be amplified further together by committee rather than standalone singular voices. And we're going to talk a little bit about that a little bit more later. But to provide some of that context about whether it started, you know, individually as a committee, really the two main figures of that time in Seneca Falls were, as I said a moment ago, Elizabeth Cady Stanton. She was born in 1815. She was well-educated, married an abolitionist and a lecturer. His name was Henry Stanton. And Elizabeth became active in the anti-slavery movement, which at that point in our country's history really was, you know, a tipping point. And she worked alongside other leading abolitionists of that day, and she took the cause to another level, addressing such issues for women, which was maternity, divorce law, and even married women's property tax litigation. And the other person, the other woman who was with her by her side in 1848 in that meeting in Seneca Falls was Lucretia Mott. And Lucretia was a Quaker, and she was born in 1793, a few years, you know, on before before Elizabeth. And her upbringing was all about equality of all people under God. You know, they were very much, you know, God-centered people. Well, in 1803, Lucretia was a member of the American Anti-Slavery Society. That shaped her life as an abolitionist as well. And she met Elizabeth, a fellow suffragette, as they were called, at the 1840 World Anti-Slavery Convention held in London. So they took the boats over, you know, steamed over to London, you know, and of course at that time, think about how long it took them to get there. And Elizabeth had just gotten married to her husband, Henry, and they were honeymooning in London. But she also, yeah, get that. And they also, she was attending this convention. So at that point, that's when the two of them met. And they're in really Stanton's influence for Mott's activism for women's suffrage really took root at that time when Lucretia came back home to the United States from London, from the convention. The groundwork was laid for their movement.
They must have been so jazzed. Was there any organization such as Women's Rights Convention or something like that?
Yeah, there really weren't at the time. There were splinter groups out there, each kind of doing their own thing. So the Women's Rights Convention, as it was known and came to be at that time in 1848 in Seneca Falls, New York, really was the manifestation of those efforts, not only of Stanton and Mott, but many others that we could speak to, you know, whether it was, you know, of the time, you know, certainly, you know, the work that had been done by Susan B. Anthony and others, it came up, came later. But during the first Women's Rights Convention, what's also really important to talk about, what really solidified this convention of women's rights was the authoring by Elizabeth Stanton of the Declaration of Sentiments. It expanded on what I just talked about earlier, the Declaration of Independence. And by adding what she did in this reauthoring called the Declaration of Sentiments was adding the word woman or women throughout the document. Mm-hmm. And this declaration, this Declaration of Sentiments really oftentimes isn't talked about, but this document called for social and legal changes to elevate a woman's place in society. And further, this declaration also listed 18 grievances, from the inability to control their own wages and own property, or the difficulty in, you know, having custody when there was a divorce, to the lack of the right to vote. So it really, it really was a game changer in building coalitions of broad-based support. And in closing on this topic, Stanton really took it a step further, and she circulated petitions and documents and had many different speeches throughout the state of New York in 1848 when they left Seneca Falls, and to urge the New York Congress at the time to pass the New York Married Women's Property Act, which was really consequential. So just that Women's Rights Convention at that point really solidified the movement.
It's amazing how many of the things you mentioned are still issues today. And this, by the way, is the 100th anniversary of the women's suffrage amendment being added to the Constitution, which we'll get to. And, Richard, were men involved in the movement too?
Yes, they were, Dan. Yes, they were. You remember these women, as we were just talking about, not only Lucretia and Elizabeth, but the many others that were involved in the movement of both races. You know, it was a very ethnic blend, which was quite unusual also for that time, that men played that role. And a lot of it really came down to not only their husbands of the suffragettes standing by them on the movement and supporting the cause, because remember, a lot of them were anti-slavery and abolitionists, but there were many others. And one notable one in speaking of anti-slavery was Frederick Douglass. And Frederick Douglass, with Elizabeth and Lucretia being founding members of the Women's Rights Convention, they were bolstering also the anti-slavery movement across the country. And they invited Frederick Douglass, who was at that time a freed slave, an African-American abolitionist, to attend the Seneca Falls gathering in 1848. And so he stood there at this Women's Rights Convention. After they had their formal meeting, they invited men in to come speak, the supporters. And he was one of those supporters. And he, you know, sat there and supported the equal rights. And that really you know, connected and resonated beyond that Women's Rights Convention floor that day or those days in Seneca Falls that inspired the movement. And for listeners out there wanting to learn more about the men behind the movement, certainly Frederick Douglass, you can check out the Frederick Douglass National Historic Site online through the National Park Service and others. And for those of your listeners that are, able to visit it, it's quite remarkable, the stories behind the stories for the men that were involved.
We're talking with Richard Peterson, publisher of The Cultural Traveler. Richard, since women's suffrage began at a time when slavery was a political issue, as you mentioned, were people who opposed slavery also involved in helping women? To what extent were they involved?
Could you ask the question? You broke up there for a moment, Dan.
Oh, I'm sorry. Since women's suffrage began at a time when slavery was a political issue, were people who opposed slavery also involved in helping women secure their rights?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There was this blend that, really traversed it, because the anti-slavery movement and the abolitionists, those men and those officials, both on the on the state side and on the national side, were not only listening to the process of what was happening, but were actually acting on it. So as slavery, yes, was a political issue and became a touchstone for much change that came later on in our history, and continues to this day. Really, that was a catalyst. And as I said earlier, having the likes of Frederick Douglass standing there, bringing all the support from his round of abolitionists, but also all those right there in their own communities, was a huge, huge part in the women securing their rights.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Richard, but didn't some states allow women to vote during revolutionary times during the 18th century?
Dan, that's really interesting. Actually, yes, I'll give one example. In 1776, New Jersey allowed women to vote. And, even though it's debated by, historians and scholars today about what Thomas Jefferson at the time and what the Patriots at the time meant when they declared that, quote, all men are created equal, did our nation's founders mean that, males only, or were there some situations when men could mean all humans? So the unique case of the women voters in New Jersey offered some insights. And what really happened was that the framers of New Jersey's first constitution in 1776 gave the vote to all inhabitants of the colony. Remember, we were colonies at that point, and a full age, and those who were worth 50 pounds, and that's 50 pounds sterling, and had resided within the county of the colony for 12 months. So the other states or colonies at the time restricted voting only to men, but it really was an interesting point. So yes, they were able to vote, but in very, very small numbers.
So what did women lose their early right to vote? Wasn't it up to the states?
Yes, as much as now up to the states today, and a lot of our democracy, as you see with, an election year and ballot by ballot, state by state, county by county, there are different votes that, different types of votes that are made. Yes, but they ignored the state constitution of the time. And it really was in 1807 when the New Jersey state legislature, among others within the state, restricted the vote to only white male citizens who paid taxes. So literally from 1776 to 1807 in New Jersey and other areas of the country, very, very select, they were able to vote, but it was very restricted. And certainly the listeners can learn more about this through the Revolutionary War historical sites. One of the places I go to a lot when I'm doing research is nps.gov, which is the National Park Service, /Rev War, R-E-V-W-A-R. So it really helps give you some further insights into that.
Can you tell us about Susan B. Anthony and the museum that keeps her memory alive?
Well, Susan B. Anthony is an icon among icons for many in our world today. And she really was one of those catalysts that brought forth, just a motivation and an inspiration for the people of the movement. You're going to hear a little bit more about her next week when Nancy Han Bono, who authored a really wonderful article on this period, spoke to it. But she, as a main contributor, she illegally voted in the 1872 election. And was fined at that point $100. Think about 1872. I would love to hear the calculation of what that would be in today's dollars, a fine of $100. But Susan B. Anthony is now, her home is really at the birthplace of where a lot of folks, which is right outside and adjacent to Seneca Falls in Rochester, New York. So the Susan B. Anthony Museum at House and Museum is available, unfortunately, right now due to restrictions with many museums that are beginning to reopen now across the country due to the pandemic. You can certainly visit it virtually, but certainly you can learn more about it at susanb.org, www.susanb.org. But it's a really she's just a champion for so many ways. But you're going to hear a little bit more of that next week, so make sure your listeners tune in.
So aside from the fine, was she arrested for trying to vote?
She was arrested. And looking at the history, she was arrested and fined. But it wasn't as catastrophic as people would think. I think it was just more of like teaching a lesson. Because when you have those prominent figures in the movement, it's about not only it's paying restitution, but also showing that that they meant business about the inability of the women's suffrage movement at that point.
Hmm. Okay, well, advancing to the 20th century, did women's suffrage marches and demonstrations finally make a dent with Congress and the White House?
In one word, yes. Yes. The efforts of many women and the convention and the followers brought women of all ages and all ethnicities to the streets of Washington, New York, and others that we've been talking about to ensure that their voices were heard. And certainly, as a former Washingtonian resident myself, though I'm now living here in California and based here in San Francisco, Washington, D.C. is the place to go when you want to protest to your government or have your voices heard. And so even then, marching down the street in their white dresses or clothing with their sashes and their flags, very peacefully protesting the right to vote really did help bring attention to it. But more, of course, had to be done. But yes, it was a big part of it.
We are talking with Richard Peterson, publisher of The Cultural Traveler. Mary Ellen?
Richard, when Woodrow Wilson was the president when women's suffrage was approved in 1920, would you say he helped or he hindered the movement?
He's got an interesting story, this man. Yeah.
Okay.
Wilson, he's a very interesting individual. So the day before his second, from his aspect of what he did, but the day before his second inauguration, Alice Paul herself, a suffragette of the time, and she's got an amazing story. We could do an entire episode on Alice, and you can certainly learn more about her after the show. She was the leader of the militant wing of the women's movement, and she helped organize a march of 8,000 women in the time in the streets of Washington, D.C., right to the White House protesting suffrage. And despite that, Wilson was able to ignore suffrage for most of that first term. Actually, this was the day before his first inauguration. So as the Republican Party had been split for the election, and Wilson was able to hide behind the Democratic platform during this whole process, it really took shape as he went into, and, you know, they protested all the time, but it really took shape in his second term, where in January of 1917, the suffragettes, led by Alice Paul, still, and others, took to the outside of the White House day and night. And they had banners and flags and signs and stood there in the cold and in the rain. And for 2 months into March, when they were eventually being arrested for disrupting traffic and blocking streets, but it was not until, and this is his pivotal moment as president, that Wilson addresses Congress in 1918. And he's, you know, he's now, you know, been brought in for his second term already. And he finally publicly endorses the suffrage movement by the federal government. And it took another year, though, before there were enough votes in Congress to support the passage of the amendment. And finally, even under all of that, under Wilson's support, it took another year for the states to ratify that amendment.
Wow. So how did it actually become a law? Wasn't it a... Now, you mentioned it's a constitutional amendment.
Well, it took a long time from the movement, you know, from Seneca Falls to the first convention to the ratification of the amendment in 1920. I mean, literally from beginning to end, it was more than 70 years. So when you think about, from beginning to the end, 70 years. And the 19th Amendment did not guarantee any woman the right to vote. Rather, the laws being reserving the ballot for men, became unconstitutional. So women still had to go through a series of state laws based on citizenship and age and mental competence and residency in order to actually vote. And the amendment also did not guarantee to Black women. They were a large contributor to the women's suffrage movement, the marches, the protests, the calls to actions, but literally it wasn't until the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that provided the ability for Black women to finally vote.
That is amazing. And speaking of amendments, isn't it true that the Equal Rights Amendment still has not been ratified by enough states to become law? And isn't there just one state left?
One state? I believe, you know, I don't know if I can answer that one for you right now. That's a really good question. I know that from the under the Equality Rights Amendment, there probably is some work that still needs to be done there, and it actually comes into equal pay for equal work. But I believe that you'll be hearing a little bit more about that next week from Nancy. She's got some interesting insights into the Equal Rights Amendment. We were just chatting about it today.
Okay, sounds good. How have women's rights improved in the 100 years since the approval of women's suffrage?
You know, women's rights have improved, you know, greatly, but so much work has to be done. Let's look at 2020. Let's look where we are, not only around, you know, certainly equal rights, equal pay, but also around the ability for, you know, blended, work and family, the ability, in representation in the workforce. So women's rights for women's suffrage, you know, the women's women's progress and the women's ability is no different, you know, for some generations than it was then. The vote is very important, but equal access and equality into the law is something that is really needs to still be addressed and is being addressed, as we know, as a nation. And in some cases, due to now the national conversations on women's rights, equality will always be an issue of conversation, but the women's rights movement has certainly moved that forward. And it now has, in my opinion, a front row seat more so than it ever has before, which is really remarkable and is well-deserved.
Okay, you're listening to Travel Witch Radio with Dan Schlossberg and Mary Ellen Nugent-Lee. Listen live on iTunes or blogtalkradio.com or check out the archive show on Facebook. And Richard, we're talking with Richard Peterson, publisher of The Cultural Traveler. Mary Ellen?
For years we've been hearing about equal pay for equal work, but is that really just still a pipe dream in most places?
I don't, you know, the 19th Amendment, you know, as it was passed in 1920, was a catalyst for that. However, 43 years later, the Equal Pay Act was, you know, it took 43 liters for it to pass in 1963, which was an adjustment to the Fair Labor Standards Act for listeners who don't know that. But 57 years on, women are still building momentum to achieve equal pay. And to learn more about that, I would visit the Center for American Progress online, where you'll see in the most recent census data from 2018 that on average, women still earn only 82 cents for every dollar earned by a man. There is a gap in disparity by ethnicity that they can learn more about there.
Well, you know, women played a critical role in war production when the men were in the armed services during World War II. Would you say we would not have won the war without the efforts of Rosie the Riveter and other women?
Rosie is a hero to many women today. She certainly is. And she's right here from across the bay where I live in Richmond, California. She was a real woman. She was a California waitress. Her name was Naomi Parker Fraley. She worked on the Navy machine shop right here in Richmond, California, right across the bay. And really, Rosie's, the efforts by those women to, all those women, thousands and thousands of them that took to the factory floors and machine shops really transformed what was the ability for women to also have a voice and a sense of equality and a position of equality. You can certainly learn more about it by visiting their website, and certainly, checking out the Cultural Traveler. But yeah, that definitely without the women's efforts, Rosie Riveter and the thousands of women, the war would not have turned out, I believe, the way that it had, because they were helping putting everything out to the movement.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just a couple of minutes to go here. A woman got the most votes in presidential history in 2016, but was still turned away. Do you think many Americans voted against Hillary Clinton because of her gender? And how much longer do you think it might be before we do get a female president?
I think it was a vote on both sides, and I think it depends on who you're speaking to. But no, I think we are at the cusp right now of having another national election with a lot of consequential decisions being made. Certainly, Hillary Clinton provided a lot of opportunity for gender education and around gender equality. So I think we're not that far away from having a female president. The rest of the world has enjoyed that opportunity. Why not here in the United States?
Okay, Richard, last question. Please tell us what the U.S. Cultural and Heritage Marketing Council does and what the Cultural Traveler is.
Well, the Cultural Traveler Exploring America, we're a national platform to share unique, diverse arts, culture, heritage, history, Native American and outdoor experiences from coast to coast in America. To learn more, they can visit theculturaltraveler.com. And we also have a magazine there. There's a digital download, and also to be able to sign up for our Cultural Connection newsletter that provides stories and insights on great American cultural and heritage experiences.
And don't worry, the questions that we didn't get to tonight, I will ask Nancy next week for sure. So thank you.
Absolutely.
Richard Peterson, president of U.S. Cultural and Heritage Marketing Council and publisher of The Cultural Traveler Exploring America, for being our guest on Travelwitch Radio.
Thank you, Danny Marling, for this wonderful conversation this evening and the ability to provide some context to the 100th anniversary of the women's suffrage movement.
Okay.
Thank
summer
you.
Is over. But baseball has begun. It's long playoff season. So this is your chance to get the best armchair companion for the postseason. My book, The New Baseball Bible, notes, nuggets, lists, and legends from our national pastime. 480 pages for less than a sawbuck. It's both a coffee table book and a bathroom book. Read it backwards and still enjoy it. That's The New Baseball Bible 2020 edition. Mike Trout on the cover. Get it on Amazon.com today. And that's it for this edition of Travelwitch Radio. Next week, same time, same station, same writer, and same announcers, we'll present the last half of our two-part series on the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage. Our guest will be Nancy Han Bono, president of NHB Marketing and Communications and contributor to the Cultural Traveler Exploring America. Now, this is Dan Schlossberg, along with my beautiful and talented co-host, Mary Ellen Nugent-Lee, saying thank you for your time this time. Until next time, good night and stay safe.